from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your host for Chatterbox.
And we're here. This is the Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show. My name is Alon.
And my name's Ara.
And my name is Rich.
Now, for all of those who haven't heard us, like, every week for the last 277 weeks, we do a radio show here on KFNX called the Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show. Talk about games. If you want to go to our website, chatterboxgameshow.com is the website. Today, we're going to have someone on the show later. Do you know his name?
That's right. Yes, it's actually my good friend and acquaintance and my fellow designer, Justin Linegang. He made a game called Glumbuster.
Linegang.
Just call him Justin.
Okay. He
wrote your response to Justin.
That's cool. J-Line? Can I call him J-Line?
You could and see what happens.
All right.
That'll be exciting.
Well, I was just sitting here before the show playing his game, Glumbuster, and if anybody listening wants to play, just go to glumbuster.com. Spelt just like it sounds.
That's right.
Get rid of your glum. I've been sitting here eliminating my glum by playing Glumbuster, busting the glum, as you might say. And it's weird. It's definitely weird, but it's not bad. It's very difficult to play on a laptop.
I've watched you experience this firsthand.
Yeah. Well, on a laptop with a mouse touchpad, you know, instead of an actual mouse. My Bluetooth mouse isn't. I don't know the driver setup for it, but
mouse touchpads are inconvenient.
Normally, actually, they're really
for
good.
For games.
But yeah, for games, not so good.
Yeah. I had to dig up my old mouse last week because I finally got Omicron installed. Quantic Dream's really old game from 1999.
The one that, like, requires DOS or something?
No, it just runs on DirectX 6. And, yeah, it's not very high-tech.
DirectX 6. Like, so DOS.
So, well, no, it's not DOS, though, but it's almost as old as, yeah. But okay. I was, like, playing it, and it worked fine, and I was like, oh, crap, they're shooting. And I was like, mouse pad, and then I just died right away. So I had to get my mouse.
All right, well, I'm going to figure out how to get out of the game.
So that's really exciting. And let's see. Well, we've got him coming on at around the half of the hour.
25 minutes or something?
Yeah.
If you want to call and talk to him, talk about an indie game designer, feel free. 866-536-1100. We're going to have the normal Ara quiz.
That's right, the Chatterbox quiz. I mean, I'd love to call it the Ara quiz, but, you know.
So he makes actual video games, not just like the artsy-fartsy, quote-unquote, independent game that
he's a professional designer, as I am as well.
Okay.
But apparently he can also code and put together a little game.
Well,
that's legit.
Well, we're going to ask him
if you
about
say
this
the word
game.
Legit, dude.
I'm not using the word legacy if you want me to do that. Okay. I'm just not doing it.
We're going to severely restrict Rich's vocabulary for the remainder of the show. So our quiz this week is going to be a nice smorgasbord of random questions.
Let's call it the Chatterbox quiz powered by Ara.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Okay.
Not powered by Vietnam, which is a sticker apparently I see on some cars. I don't know how a whole country could power a car, but that's a whole other story.
They got a lot of little feet.
I don't know.
Okay, so a smorgasbord, you said?
Just that's right.
A question fiesta.
Yes.
Or feast.
Yes.
Feast is what I was looking for
fiesta,
there.
Fiesta, feast. So Justin will, if he can endure us, he'll play. But if you guys want to play along too, just like last week, you're welcome to. Just give us a call, 866-536-1100.
And just like last week, the prize will be...
Absolutely nothing.
A good feeling in the cockles.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
Really not,
thanks to Alon.
Not much.
Alon
else.
Will personally come over and guarantee that feeling for you.
Probably not. My computer's running slower because Glumbuster is running, by the way. So we're going to close that.
All right. So I've got a couple of cool stories here. Maybe we can just power through some funny stories. How do you like that? How do you
can
like
I
now?
Like quit telling the story of the game?
Yes, you can, and I'll start telling some other story. So. There's been a couple of quotes from Nintendo's president, Satoru Iwata, as of late. And
you guys were talking about this just before the show
that's
started.
That's right. This is pretty cool. So there is...
Yeah.
Yes.
Iwata.
Okay. So This is what we call fantastic radio.
Yeah.
Do tell.
Yes. So
can I tell you, by the way, one of the number one most annoying things to hear on a podcast is the podcasters, or radio hosts in this case, talking about how bad their show is. Yes.
No. We're talking about good like, radio. Oh, this is what it is.
This radio show is so terrible. Like,
actually, now that we're going to harp on this, this was Adam Carolla-ism that I'm stealing from him.
Okay.
What is...
With self-degradation.
That's what Conan does every episode. He's like, oh,
he's made it
sucks.
High enough that he's allowed.
Well, he's awesome, but I mean, he does it every
okay,
day.
Okay, so getting all back right. back to Iwata. So apparently, if you guys think that Miyamoto is God, then Satoru Iwata will have something to say for you.
See, now, I have not claimed he's God, he's a very good game designer.
And certainly I don't, but I think this is funny because...
Miyamoto used to be better.
Because people think that he's actually God, I guess. I mean, this is the first time I've actually seen someone publicly say, no, this person is not God.
He's perhaps idolized. I think that's what they're trying to get at.
He is idolized. So let's read the quote, right? So... Mr. Iwata said, one of the reasons why Miyamoto is highly praised is because of his ability to stop, rethink about, and fix how he can convey the appeal of the software when he finds out during the latter phase of development that the software will not be good enough. This is why the games he's worked on have a high batting average to produce big hits. However, he is not God, and even Miyamoto himself cannot hit the mark every time, nor always predict how long it takes to complete development. So there you go, everybody. Miyamoto is officially... human.
Why
like
not?
What's interesting to think about is why can he make good games? And we've heard those stories. I was going to say we've all heard them, but I don't know if our listeners are aware of this. Like, Miyamoto will just come in and be like, you know what? We've been working on this game for months and months. No, not good enough. We need to change something. Think harder, right? And they'll have brainstorming sessions to see what is it that's not making this game really pop.
I guess.
And be excellent.
I guess.
Well, this happens. Better.
And Nintendo's willing to put something on the back burner, whereas other companies like Ubisoft, if they work on something, you know, held to high water, they're going to release it. And Miyamoto has talked about how he's had an idea for, you know, some sort of game or software, and then been like, you know what, it's just not good enough. But he keeps the idea in his head, and literally years later, multiple generations down the road in terms of hardware, he'll be like, you know what, that was a good idea that can be made better with today's technology or today's tools or whatever, and release it. And one example of this was, I wonder if it actually ever came out, but there was an E3 years and years ago, Nintendo 64, there was going to be like a camera peripheral or something. You could put yourself in the game, and it was like a little Hollywood thing where they had some examples with Miyamoto
really?
Characters in
that
it
was
and whatever.
Years before its time, apparently.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I know one thing with Miyamoto is he wanted basically the Mii characters. Is he had that idea like on the Super Nintendo, like he wanted that kind of thing.
Well, that was first implemented apparently in what I was talking about. I think
yeah.
I think that's what happened, where they took the idea from that game of putting yourself in the game as this
yeah.
cutesy character guy, and then just instead of making whole software out of it, built it into the Wii as the whole Mii concept.
And it still doesn't do anything. It just looks cute.
But it, don't you think it's been a big draw for the Wii? Like, it's,
oh yeah, it's definitely been a big draw.
It's certainly been a big factor.
Big enough for Microsoft to completely lift the concept and copy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
What's funny, I think it was really big because there was nothing else to do on the Wii when it first came
out. Well, yes, and there's always that. No, but you bring up an interesting point, right, when you mentioned Ubisoft, and I'm only saying this not because of Ubisoft specifically, but... It's interesting how, you know, okay, well, there's a lot of companies that have a tendency to, let's say, just have a much lower bar of quality when they decide about if they're going to release a game or not. And I've certainly been on the, let's just say, painful end of the stick when it comes to companies deciding that something is, in fact, not good enough.
If we could soundbite that, painful end of the stick,
and,
can we get that taken care of, Norm?
And no. So...
Now, I'm just saying if we could isolate the aura saying I've been at the painful end of the stick, that would be fascinating.
Right. I'm not saying it again.
Okay.
Okay. So the funny thing is I don't know. I mean, like it's a fine line, right? Because nobody wants shovelware, but then on the other hand, you often have to invest lots and lots of time into something, and maybe when we interview Justin later on, he'll have something to say about this. You only find out. After a certain amount of development, like, wow, I thought this was going to be awesome. This kind of sucked, right? And so you invest so much money and time into something, and then you realize that it's crap. And then you just have to make this decision where it's like, okay, well, we're just going to put it out anyway or try to make it work or just shovel the whole thing. And when you're talking about, you know, big hit games or big companies, usually that means basically, you know, saying that the millions and millions and millions of dollars you spent is just going to be a loss.
Well, let's look at this a little bit deeper, right? It also has something – it says something about – I want to say Japanese versus American style, but it may just be Nintendo versus everyone else style. Miyamoto's been around, right, since like the 70s or something when he made Donkey Kong. And
80s.
Was Donkey Kong 80s?
I don't think it was 70s.
Ooh.
It was certainly a long time. He's been with Nintendo for a long time.
Space Invaders was 78, dude.
It was early 80s.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, let's not
doesn't
let's
matter.
Not, let's not harp
long freaking time ago. At least 25 years ago. And so now if he thinks something isn't good, he can shelve it, but he might come back to it later. So think about how that would work in an American game studio. There's all sorts of turnover, there's all sorts of poaching from one company to another. You can't be sure that your developer is going to be around. And well, you also don't know that he's going to work on this various types of products.
Certainly there are cultural differences between the Japanese and Western developers.
Yeah, how many developers in an American company get to really come up with an idea for a product, push his ideas, get teams together to work on his ideas?
There's very few people who have that luxury. And I mean, I'm not even sure if Miyamoto himself actually, in fact, in reality, does have that
luxury.
Like,
the only other one I can think of is Will Wright.
Will Wright, I don't know, maybe Kojima, but these are all like just suppositions.
Kojima sits on a single game his whole life.
Ooh.
Yeah. Burn. Will Wright and Miyamoto are the only two I could think of that have that sort of style or ability. Anyway, I want to talk more about this. We'll be right back.
Arizona's News Talk Leader, KFNX, AM 1100.
Chatterboxers, it's not often we come to you with a special request or throw unnecessary commercials at you. However, you've heard us mention our new Golgatron website on the show a few times, and we're finally ready to show it off. If you're a fan of Chatterbox, you'll be a fan of Golgatron. It's simple and understated while maintaining that certain lack of refinement you secretly desire. It's also got sass. Sass and spunk. Do us a solid and check it out. You'll find a link on the Chatterbox site, or you can just head straight to Golgatron.com. That's GOLGOTRON.com.
All right, we're back. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio, and we were talking about the mortality of Shigeru Miyamoto, and we actually very nicely segued into this conversation of what the hell we were talking about.
Well, let me first remind everyone about UAT.edu. That's the website for the University of Advanced in Technology, because if you want to become as educated and as evocative as this small group of people here, then you wouldn't be hurt by starting... at UAT.
Word.
The University of Advanced Technology. So what we were talking about is the difference in styles. I don't really know how to better put it.
Just the styles that's the angle you wanted to take.
Of Nintendo versus other game companies. And it honestly may just be unique to Miyamoto, which is kind of frustrating, actually, because then what happens when he's gone, which is inevitable and probably coming up soon.
Well, you know what? I want to use this as an opportunity to say that we have some insight into what, you know, Miyamoto is like and what, you know, how they conduct their business there and what their creative process is like, right? But it's always through kind of like this, you know, this maybe like this pinhole of sorts, as it were, right? I mean, I always kind of cringe when people say like, oh, Miyamoto is like this or Kojima is like this and so-and-so is like this or that, when they don't have like necessarily firsthand evidence of it, of, you know, what they are like or what their creative processes are like. And so, you know, I've heard all kinds of stories like, oh, Miyamoto programmed, you know, this game and this other game. And then, like, you know, a couple years later, I hear, like, contradictory information. Like, no, Miyamoto was really just doing this or this other thing, right? And these are definitely, like, these are marquee names for sure, right? But I guess let's be a little bit, let's tread a little gingerly, if we
can.
What I base my discussion on is what I've heard him specifically say.
That's cool. That's
right.
Cool.
Well, what I've heard his translator say the same room as him.
I heard Miyamoto
totally kosher.
Made Ocarina of Time all by himself and his staff.
Yes, and
fed him grapes the entire time. Like, that's what they were there for. It's It's true.
Did they fan him with giant ferns?
And he...
yeah, so...
And he wears a white jumpsuit and a driving helmet all the time.
But he talks about his process. And, you know, a lot of the people at Nintendo, they talk at GDC and stuff. Like, we've heard Satoru Iwata talk.
That's definitely
true. Heard Miyamoto talk. Koji Kondo has also discussed his process, which, being the music guy, is a little bit different from game development, but it was still interesting to hear how his process differed from others. And they all have this, like, overlying concept of quality that you don't necessarily get at other companies. And by that, I don't just mean that the designer wants quality, right? Because all designers want it. They want the time, and they don't necessarily get
it. This is like make the game fun. Like, I've heard this so many times. Like, why wouldn't you make the game fun? Like, who in their right mind is thinking, I am making this game, and my objective is to not make it fun? Although, that might happen in some situations, but that's something different.
I don't think Genova-chan focuses on fun.
Right, well, that's what I'm getting at, but I digress.
I just want to make sure people know.
That's fine. Good. I'm sure we'll never meet him or be his friend now.
Whatever.
So, but at Nintendo, I don't know if they just have a board of directors who's keen on this idea, but they let the people who are the creative minds behind their products actually have some control and some decision making. So maybe it's just because Miyamoto proved himself on those early projects. I don't know what sort of control he had when Super Mario Brothers came around.
Right, right.
Or the original Donkey Kong.
And neither do I.
Right. But now, like, he'll go to other teams who are working on projects that he has nothing to do with. He'll be coined executive producer, right? Even though all he does is take a look at the game every 6 months. But, like, the original Zelda on the DS, the Phantom Hourglass or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it was controlled with the normal controls, and it just had two screens. One screen was, like, the inventory screen, and one was the game itself. And he came along and he's like, no, this isn't quite doing it for me. Integrate this and do something better and different. If it's going to be like this, why even bother releasing? It's like everything else is already done, right? Whereas other people might be satisfied with just, you know, making a slightly different storyline and some different things you can get in the game or whatever. He's just like, no, it has to be different, which honestly isn't that big of a stretch for a designer to deal with on a new piece of hardware like the DS. But that's one example of his stepping in and performing quality control as the sort of like overseeing eye that it's not quality control in that we have to get a game out so we can get money next week.
Right.
It's like, if it's not good enough, we're not going to release it. You'll get a better idea and we'll use this down the road. And because he knows he's going to be at Nintendo 12 years down the line, that's fine. He can shelve his idea about Miis, and two video game systems later, he can use that idea, actually implement it because, okay, now it makes sense. Now we found a way to do this in a way that's entertaining, right?
Yeah.
Other game companies don't have that. They don't have a person who they know is going to be around for a while. They're not willing. They don't even have a way to archive these ideas. It's just, like, I know when I'm at work and I'm handling whatever it is I handle, right? 3 weeks down the road, I'm the only one who knows what I did. Well, but luckily, I'm still there.
That is a good point. I will wager a guess, and I would guess that I have this sense that Japanese game development companies probably have a much better retention rate than Western ones in general.
Japanese all companies have just a sense of loyalty that doesn't exist in the U.S. anymore, right?
Right, right. And ironically enough, apparently game developers in Japan also get paid a lot less than they do here.
Yeah, so that's it's considered more of just a job than some sort of like fashionable thing to do, right?
Right.
And I'm sure Miyamoto doesn't make anywhere near what the...
Who knows?
The heads of game companies in America make.
Probably less than Bobby Kotick.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, I'm sure he does very well, right? But,
well, I'm sure too.
But not like people in America do, where they're just making millions of dollars and driving 8 Ferraris. Well, like, it's unnecessary.
Some of them, a few of them.
So, but, I mean, there's also been a lot of discussion, just totally away from the video game industry, just discussing, loyalty and... how different cultures work and how America used to have loyalty to companies, and you would have people who work for AT&T or GM or something for 40 years and retire, get their, you know, their gold watch and their severance pay or whatever. They would actually get money for the rest of their lives and benefits, and we don't do that anymore. So why be loyal, right?
Right.
And in Japan, I don't know how they work, but they probably take care of their people once they leave the company, as long as they've been there long enough.
So one thing I wanted to bring up about Nintendo that I did actually read in an interview way back when was regarding their process about, basically just how they prototype their games, right? And it does seem actually very distinctly different from how a lot of American games are made. Now, usually the way a lot of American games are made is, some company says, oh, look, this product... making lots of money. Maybe it's an existing game. Maybe it's a movie. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's some kind of franchise, right? How can we cash in on this? Oh, we can make a game about this because this is this topic is making money, be it, I don't know, like UFC or a movie or another popular game series. And okay, so let's go and do this again and let's make it a game, right? And so they fund this game. And so the people who are actually developing the game then are basically tasked with, like, you know, just figure out how to make a game out of this topic, and it needs to make a lot of money because, you know, well, just because we're going to invest a lot of money into it, right? So the way that I understand, at least Nintendo used to do things, which they probably still do, is that they kind of like take a completely opposite approach where they tend to basically prototype mechanics, right? Completely separate from the actual subject matter. And so this I find to be a much more interesting way of making a game, because you say, oh, you know what? Like, I'll just give you like a trivial example, right? Like, oh, I want to see what you can do with like jumping and shooting, right? I'm like, okay, that's Mega Man, right? But they'll do something like that, and they'll be like, okay, let's prototype this concept, right? So the concept is a mechanical one. It's not a thematic one. And so they'll work on it for a while, and then apparently they'll do this with a lot of different concepts. And when they get one that's compelling enough, then only then are they like, okay, you know what? This is really compelling. Now can we think of a theme that fits this?
That's probably how Wii Play and Wii Sports came about, right?
And testing
mechanics.
It very well may have. And I think that that's a much, much smarter way to make a game, because the game, after all, is really what you are doing. The theme of it is, I mean, a lot of people argue against this, but I won't, is really just like a wrapper, you know? I mean, it's not the centerpiece, even though it may be the first thing you notice. It's not really the centerpiece or the essence or the soul of the game.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I've never actually thought about that consciously. But when I
have that effect on people.
When I sit down with myself and I think to myself, self, I want to design a game, which happens all the time. Of course, I'm not a professional designer and I don't actually end up putting these games into production, but I have ideas.
Right. Well, usually people think of the theme first just because it's the most obvious aspect.
Like, I remember a few weeks ago, I came to you and said, you know what? I want to make a game that somehow has to do with just, you ever play pinball and you know the bumpers on the pinball table? I told you this. I hope you remember this conversation.
I completely forgot.
We had a conversation here in the studio and I said, pinball has bumpers at the top of the play field, right? Usually at the top.
Everywhere else.
When a ball hits it, it bounces off really fast. Sure. I want to make a game that I haven't thought about it at all. I would like to have a game that implements a ball and bumpers as the main like gameplay element.
Sure, why not?
I haven't thought about how you would control it or what the world would be like, but I'd love to have a game that deals with bumpers. And that, by the way, was before I played Peggle.
Yes,
and realized that at exactly the same time I was having that idea, Peggle had just been made.
Yes, and that can be frustrating. But
yeah.
Yes, I mean, I think that that's generally how Nintendo does things, and I really wish a lot more game companies would take that approach.
Clearly, I should be a designer. I'm up for hire. You guys let me know. Send me an email. I'd be happy to do it.
Maybe,
bumpers.
Maybe you can talk to Justin.
He's online. We'll bring him on. We're going to break now. We'll be right back. And if you want to call us, feel free. 866-536-1100. We'll get you conferenced on with Justin and us. And it'll just be so much fun. We'll be right back.
It's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one.
As we promised, we are back. Chatterbox Video Game Radio. We had a break, and now we want to talk to Justin Line Gang. Am I getting that right?
You got that perfectly
Gang
right.
Gang Bang something.
Line Gang.
That's all I want to say.
Line Gang. That's right.
All right. You are on the air, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, what's up, Justin?
Hey, what's going on, Ara?
We're playing your game before the show started. Well, that's really me.
Yeah, well, it was you, but I was watching you, and I did play it before, too. So, but Rich hasn't played it, so.
I looked at it for like 10 seconds, and like stuff was on the screen, and I was like, okay.
Now, I want to say that I got pretty far, but I actually have no idea how big the game is, so it's not okay for me to say that I got really far. But I got over that, like, castle piece thing.
You got farther than I did, so I'll give you credit.
And you turn into, like, the black-cloaked dude, and you have to shoot yourself over the thing, over to the other area, and then there's more stuff and things. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you're familiar with the game. You've played it a couple times, right?
Yeah, once or twice.
All right. So we actually have someone who I guess wants to join in the discussion, but we're going to wait till next segment for that. For now, we're going to interview a little bit. And Ara, do you want to take it away here?
Yeah, well, why don't you start out by just telling us a little bit about what Glumbuster is?
It's a video game, of course. It's really actually hard for me to even explain what it is, because I don't honestly really know fully what it is beyond the set of play mechanics that it is. I mean, really, for me, that's all it was and is still.
Well, let's take this angle. Maybe you can talk to us a bit about, you know, what was the impetus behind the game? You know, what was, you know, your intent when you first got the idea of the game? How did you get the idea and all that other good stuff?
Let me jump in. Before we do that, can you give our listeners a sort of the elevator speech about what the game is?
An exploration of a set of concerted and kind of coordinated interactions. I mean, my big goal beyond anything was to explore a set of interactions that came about through a prototype I created that was completely founded on the simultaneous interaction of both hands and engaging the mind in both hands all simultaneously in different ways continuously.
Pain in the ass, by the way.
Now this is really interesting, because as you're saying this, Justin, this just puts a big smile on my face, because we seem to have come from like this. There's, I don't know, you know, we both lived in Austin, right? I mean, you still live in Austin, right?
Right.
And there's just like this group of game developers that we were all in. I mean, I guess you could call it a clique or whatever, but we seem to all have like this shared like culture about I guess video game philosophy. And yeah, so what you're saying right now, like, is just, I'm just like, yeah, I'm really digging it right now.
Cool.
Yeah, all
right, we definitely do all share that in common. I mean,
so I want to describe to the listeners here. There's this game. You start off, you're this tiny, tiny little dude, right? Like the size of the worm characters in the game Worms, in this environment that doesn't have like a terrible amount of detail, right? There's a good amount of contrast between your character and the world. It's outdoors, usually, at least. Walking around, and you want to get, like, usually the screen is, well, at the beginning, the screens are mostly static, right? And then they scroll a bit, become larger than the world becomes larger than the screen. And the mouse does, the buttons do two things, right? So you move the mouse on the screen and it moves this sort of cursor-ish thing. And if you press with one mouse button, then it sort of fires a red object, right? And if you use the other mouse button, then you can create this triangle of three spots, which can collect, you know, like the essence of the bad guys after you've shot them or something. And I guess killing them all allows you to get to the next area, and then later on you can interact with other things in the world that help like shoot you further in the world or something. So it's platformer-ish, but like he was saying, you have to move around with the, you know, up, down, left, and right keys, move your character around while also having to deal with the mouse and shooting stuff and collecting things with the mouse. And you're saying that was sort of part of the focus of your prototype, is having to use both inputs at once?
Correct. Yes.
Now, wouldn't that, doesn't part of you say that that's a frustration rather than an interesting mechanic?
No, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, from the outset, I think it might be a turnoff for a lot of people and it might be a frustration, but truly, I feel that it's an interesting challenge from my perspective, but from a human perspective, something that, you know, we naturally do in our everyday lives is use both of our hands controlled by our brains, you know, and it's something we do naturally, something we do with everything we interact with. And we learn and we adapt, you know, to new things. We always, anything new we pick up on, it's the way we explore it. And through those interactions, we learn pattern relationships, we learn interaction relationships and everything like that. And it's a satisfaction that ultimately comes when we do learn and master those things. And Glumbuster, by and large, from start to finish, if you ever do manage to play more of the game, I can probably bet that you'll discover as you go along a very gratifying sense of accomplishment and discover a sense of discovery.
Have you played Schizoid on Xbox Live Arcade?
No, I haven't.
All right, go play that just to do yourself a favor, because it's a totally different gameplay experience, but it forces you to use both analog sticks to deal with two different entities on the screen a little bit more fully than yours, because in your case you have a character and you have a cursor,
right.
And you could, like me, most of the time I was moving the character and then dealing with shooting at a different point. And I assume as the game, you know, progresses, you have to use them both in combination a little bit more. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So Schizoid sort of does the same thing. It's a little easier at the beginning, but really to get good at it, you have to use both of them. And if my watching Dr. House on TV like every night is any indication, I've learned that you know, one side of the brain manages the cognitive functions, the handle motion and pattern perception and all that stuff, and the other side of the brain, which controls one of your hands, doesn't. So you're basically training one part of your brain to do something that it doesn't normally do. Like I said earlier, pain in the ass, but still cool. Like you, I like to challenge myself and do things that I haven't been able to do before, so that's cool, but not easy. And traditionally, at least, I don't know, traditionally, lately, the last few years, there's been a real movement into making things easy and accessible. And so you don't find stuff like this that really pushes the boundaries of what your brain can handle very often. Now, there's all sorts of questions about just indie development in general, right?
Yeah, well, I wanted to let's just get some stats out of the way if we can, right? I'm just kind of curious, Justin, like, did you work on this all yourself, and how long did it take, and, you know, what are some of the tools you used, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
It took me a little over 4 years, yes, 100% by myself, which is by and large why it took pretty much 4 years to...
So you did the sound, the graphics, the programming, everything?
I did everything but the music.
Ah.
That happens a lot, actually.
Well...
People get someone else who really knows music to do.
Which happens.
I think it ends up having a better feel, because musicians have something special about them that a lot of other people don't have.
Sometimes.
All right, I didn't mean to interrupt. You go right ahead.
That's perfectly fine. So, and like, tools-wise, it's all developed in a platform called Game Maker, so which is a suite of an underlying engine and then also a programming and organizational tool set. And then I did all the visuals using ProMotion. I used Photoshop here and there for little things, but most of it was done in ProMotion.
By the way, I like the butterflies a lot.
Oh, the butterflies?
Yeah. Butterfly, unless they're not butterflies, they're something else, in which case maybe you didn't achieve your goal.
They're whatever the heck you want them to be.
Okay. Little things that flap. I thought it was well done.
So there's one other question I have, and that's, what was the most important or like the most unexpected thing that you learned through the process of making this?
That I'm not in control and I shouldn't be in control.
And so can you expound on that a little bit?
What I mean by that is basically, you know, there were plenty of times where I felt something needed, or I wanted something to be one way or the other, but it was something I had to fight against, because as I would observe other people playing or as I would play myself, it wasn't correct. It was not right for the game. So that was something that I actually had a hard time chewing on at first. You know, was that experience of, you know, I'd be working with the mechanics and everything, and then I'd have a concept of taking it in one direction because something would pop into my head, and I would start working in that direction, and it, like I said, I would observe people using it and everything, and it would not work. I would not be enjoying it, and I would almost have to force myself out of that, like trying to force it to work.
All right, we got to go to break. Keep that in mind. Keep that thought in mind. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio, and we're here with our guest, Justin Leingang, maker of Glumbuster the Game.
You can go to glumbuster.com.
That's right.
And, in fact, you should, because just during the break here, Rich was telling us, because he hasn't played the game.
Rich's mind
no
is blown.
I concept of what's happening.
Well, it's important. So you're here to sort of represent the listeners to us, and so we know now, after running an entire segment of the show, that you have no idea what's going on, which indicates to us that our listeners probably also have no idea what's going on.
So they should just go play the game.
So before I try to explain it some more, I'm going to have them, I want them to go to two websites. One of them is the University of Advanced Technologies, UAT.edu, which I always want you to go visit. And second is glumbuster.com. And download the game and play it. You got to have Windows, I assume. It's, you know, an executable file. And
by the way, apparently everybody in chat says the game never closes. Like, at least three people report when they close it, it doesn't close.
I had a heck of a time getting it closed, but once I hit quit in the game, eventually it did go away.
And he was saying, like, he's trying to open the task bar and end task, and it, like, wouldn't. And I told him it was probably his computer's fault, but
it does kind of take over.
Yeah.
That's a complaint. I'll send the complaint to the developer.
Regardless.
How about that? Version 1.3. So anyway, it's definitely difficult to understand what we're talking about if you haven't seen the game. It's not, I don't want to make our listeners think it's some really crazy diversion from existing games. It, like Rich was saying, every game uses both hands. What's the big deal? Right. But there's a difference between controlling two elements on screen at once that interact with things in their own independent ways than, you know, controlling strafing with your character and his aim. Right. There's a difference between first person shooter control where you move and aim, but those two things both deal with how the single character interacts with the world, versus something like Schizoid or Glumbuster, where the two different motion controls affect two different elements on the screen. Now, at least in the case of Glumbuster, it's not two characters. It's one character and one, like, reticle. But they're still working independently, and like I said, well, like he confirmed, later in the game it becomes more difficult where they have to work, sync. What's the word I'm looking for?
Not more difficult, more interesting, more challenging.
I'm challenging and difficult, sir.
No.
Let's review the meanings. I'm going to say that yes, it's more challenging and more difficult to pick up. But I imagine once your mind gets used to it, that a major portion of that difficulty goes away. Anyway, that's just me speculating because I haven't even played enough of the game yet. But I wanted our listeners to know that if they want what we're saying to make sense, it'll totally make sense if they play it.
I'm going to go play it when I get home, and I don't know.
Right.
I'll see what happens. I might write something about it on our websites.
Okay.
And then people can read about it.
So we've got Scott, one of our longtime listeners, on the air, and we're going to bring him on for a second, assume that he has some questions relevant to the topic. I hope, Scott.
Actually, Scott. I wasn't... talking about the Nintendo thing, but
I think we should let you should ask Justin a question. I think that's what you should do, Scott.
Or we can keep you around to play in the Chatterbox
All right,
quiz.
Let's keep him around, and then Justin and Scott will play the quiz.
One thing that was going on in the chat room as well, and one thing I liken it to is that when people said, you know, the first person controller is one hand aiming, one hand shooting. One thing that makes it more difficult is, let's say if you're talking about the game Fahrenheit or Indigo Prophecy, whatever you want to call it, there's one spot where they actually make you aim your gun with your left thumbstick, which is completely counterintuitive to everything you've played on the Xbox before. And it was nearly impossible
what you're talking
to
about.
Aim.
Because I played it on PC, and you can't aim with the keyboard on any PC game.
Well, he's talking about the Xbox.
Yeah, so nobody played it on Xbox, sorry.
Don't listen to
Rich. It was kind of broken, but still, it's just like they actually changed the mechanic on you, and you're just aiming with one hand, but it's the wrong one, so it just feels weird, and you never actually aim anything. But
I'm sure that's because you're right-handed. I mean, I know games you can switch.
I'm lefty.
And well, I know there are other games.
Burn.
I'm actually lefty too, but I still play it that way. But there are other games that you can actually on Xbox. I think Time Splitters, I want to say, but it could be wrong, where you can switch it and aim with the left and move with the right. It's weird, but some people prefer it that way.
I think that's because Time Splitters
is
sort of
crazy in general.
Well, it's made by the people who started their first person work
all
on
right.
the Nintendo 64.
Let's not get off track.
Yeah, yeah, we're way off track.
We don't have, we don't have a lot of time left.
What, you don't think that Justin likes to talk about video games?
He does, but let's have him talk more about his own game.
We never go off track like this.
No, no. Never. Okay, so Justin, tell us a little bit more about this charityware thing.
Oh, so it's basically just it's a quote unquote revenue model, I guess you could say. My big goal was to actually experiment with a way to bring in money for charity. I figured I had this brilliant concept of the way people think. Sorry to make anybody feel like a guinea pig, if that makes you feel like a guinea pig. But I figured if I provided people with a goal and a motivation and kind of an enemy, for lack of a better term, that they might be more willing to just give charitably. So that's why I developed the model as, so at first, I'm getting, it started out with 51%, and so the charity would be getting 51%, so I'm getting 49% of everything, but the more people donated, the less I would get. So again, my goal was to have them view me as kind of a challenge or an obstacle for them to overcome. So it's a goal-based thing. So
according to the website, you have the first round of 25 payments, you donate. It says after the first round of 25 payments, you are going to give 51% of the income to charity, and in the second round, 52, and then 53, and then 54. So that sounds to me like 49 payments, not 25. Are the first 25 payments you're collecting 100% of?
No.
So
49%. 51% of the first 25 goes to charity. 52% of the second 25, 53% of the third, 54.
Oh, 25 payments. I see what you're saying. So 25 people pay you,
correct,
and that's 51% going to charity. The next 25 people who pay you, 52%.
52% goes.
Ah, and it doesn't matter how much they give.
No.
So doesn't that just encourage people to give you pennies at a time?
That's perfectly fine. I actually had anticipated them giving more people just being like, oh, shoot, I can just give, you know, a couple bucks because that's working towards taking more away from me quicker. So.
And has that been how it's panned out?
No, actually it hasn't. It's been fewer people giving larger sums, which completely shocked me. So.
Well, that's pretty cool.
That's interesting.
So did you develop this concept on your own or had it already been done?
It was something I developed on my own.
Okay, so let me review this for everybody. If you pay him for the game, it's up to you. Then most of your money will go to charity no matter what. No matter how you slice it, more than half is going to charity. But the more people who pay him, the more money, more amount or percentage ends up going to charity. And eventually he gets virtually nothing and all the payment just goes to charity, which is great. It means that eventually you basically have donated the game to charity.
So everyone should tell their friends to pay him.
Which also means, by the way, that you should pick a non-controversial charity so that you don't get rid of half of your audience. Starlight Children's Foundation is the charity that you've chosen, right?
Right.
All right. So this is pretty neat. It's something that I hadn't really thought of before.
I hope that's not controversial.
I don't know. They don't hurt children with Starlight, do they?
they try not to.
Okay, so I assume it's a good thing. There's a link on the site, so I could go learn more about it if I was so inclined. But, you know, I'm going to assume that it's a good thing. I just think it's an interesting way to do it. And like you said, it's sort of a challenge to the people who pay attention to the game.
Well, I hope millions and millions of people take on that challenge. But we don't have a lot of time left. But is there anything else you'd like to say about Glumbuster, Justin?
All I can say is I honestly, you know, encourage you to try it. And, like, really stick with it. I mean, I'm not just saying that because it's my game, but it's a very interesting learning experience.
No, he has a point there, even though it's his game.
And, by the way, you can dig it from Glumbuster.com, which will get more attention on the whole, like, here's a game that you can play for free and give to charity. All right.
As our most people won't know this, who this is, but Justin does. As our good friend Peter Ong would say, you know, most of the greatest works of fiction, you know, were never necessarily appreciated right away after the first page.
Yes.
So now it's time for the Chatterbox quiz, right, powered by Aura.
So are you ready for the quiz, Justin?
Better hurry up.
I hope so.
Okay, so we've got Justin. We've got Scott here.
Scott is going to come back on the air. We've got basically 2 minutes to run this quiz.
All right, guys. So this is just going to be a random smorgasbord of questions. You're there, Scott, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
This is our third, not annual, but weekly.
There you go. Okay. So we're going to have about, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 questions. We'll see how far we get.
Lightning round.
The first question is, what percentage of the game industry lost their jobs in the past 11 months?
Scott, this goes to you.
I'm going to say 11.
All right. How about you, Justin?
27.
Okay. Actually, the answer is 12%. Scott is correct on this one.
Wow.
Right.
Wow, 1%
off. Now, all right, let's keep going. All right, so according to a recent Penny Arcade survey of 38,000 gamer nerds, how many hours did they spend per week on average?
Playing games?
Playing
or
games.
Or living?
Playing games.
Okay.
Playing video games.
And it's video game nerd.
Okay, Scott, what's your answer?
Well, he was part of the survey, that's not fair.
Probably 30.
Okay, how about you, Justin?
I was going to say 31.
Okay, actually, you both are wrong. It's 18.
Oh.
Really? Not as big nerds as we all thought.
That's 3 hours
were
a day and none on the weekend, right?
So they weren't WoW nerds, I assume.
I guess they weren't WoW. Okay, so
more question.
One more, all right. So according to the same survey, what was the most popular game genre amongst everybody surveyed?
First-person shooter.
Or,
What do you
RPG.
Think? Okay, actually, RPG was number one, FPS was number two.
I think that's because of the crowd. RPG, I don't think, is the most popular all around.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Yeah. Anyway. Penny Arcade, right?
All
right,
guys.
Clearly, this is the end of the show. Thank you very much, Justin, for coming on, and thank you for calling in as well. Scott, head over to glumbuster.com to learn more about the game that we've been talking about all show, and go to golgotron.com. We have a new gallery up there, photo gallery of Chick with video game stuff. No other reason to watch it, but go look at a girl in a bikini. Golgotron.com. We'll be at E3 next week reporting also on Golgotron.com.
Good night, guys.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your base are belong to us.